Hello and welcome to K9 Bingequake, the obscure Doctor Who spin-off podcast about tin dogs and tinfoil hats. Today I'm wearing my tinfoil in a sort of wrapped around the dreads, sort of cultural appropriation, don't think about it too hard, look inspired by our icon Georgie. How are you wearing your tinfoil today, Tom?
I am wearing my tinfoil in the rather strange little hood things, little peaky hoods that the other characters wear. Yep, it's a look I quite like.
And today we are, of course, joined by a special guest, Neo. How would you be wearing your tinfoil, Neo?
As tightly as I can.
I'm sure most people listening to this will already know of the Who Cares podcast. But if you're not aware, Neo presents that. It's absolutely wonderful stuff. Really, really good in-depth deep dives into things. So if you don't know it, you should go check it out. But is Neo, is this your first time guesting on someone else's podcast?
Yes, it is. I'm honored to be here. Yes.
And speaking of firsts, was this your first time seeing the Australian K9 TV show?
Yes. Yeah, I'd been avoiding it, I suppose.
Were you aware of it when it came out in 2009-10?
Yeah, I was aware of it. So it was on Channel 10, which is like a... it's one of the free-to-air channels that's not particularly good, but none of them are. But I was aware that this existed, but I wasn't that interested in watching it. I wasn't watching Doctor Who itself in 2010, back in those days. I was keeping up with Torchwood, but K9 didn't look like something of interest to me.
Yeah, if you were gravitating towards the more adult stuff, I can imagine K9 would be quite low down the list of, yeah.
You mean this isn't intense adult drama?
So you were aware it existed, and I presume, like most people, you've basically given it no thought in the years since, until being asked to come and do this with us. Is that right?
Yeah, I think it's a combination of, it seems very tangential in a way that, you know, Torchwood and the Sarah Jane Adventures are very closely related to the Mothership show, so they get talked a lot about in relation that way. And then there are other spin-offs which aren't closely related, but they're also really good, or they have very firm fandoms, and so they get talked about lots in those ways, like some of the more extended universe ones. But this one seems very pitched down to kids. I didn't feel particularly invited in watching this as an adult, so I'm not surprised it hasn't really courted much fandom since. It was kind of facile, I suppose. It felt very... it was just pitched very down, I found. You watch something like the Sarah Jane Adventures, and it's clearly made for children, first and foremost, but I don't feel excluded watching it as an adult, exactly. It still feels like it's trying to be a certain level of drama. Maybe this was trying to be as well, but I just feel like there are a lot of things in the mix that weren't really cohering together into much of an experience, let alone an enjoyable one.
The word disposable could have been invented to describe it. I mean, you know, let's be fair. I think one of the things we were saying before is that the fact that each story is only a 25-minuter, or even less than that, like a 22-minute kind of go, rather than at least the Sarah Jane's are two installments of 25, 30 minutes. So that each part has to be sort of so quickly rushed through and resolved very quickly, that there's just not really ever any time to do very much of depth.
And also there's the slight impression this might not have any money or something. I don't know. There is a very brief scene of the nightmare monster walking down the street, because this is an episode about a monster that puts people to sleep and sort of feeds off their dreams and wants to put the whole world to sleep. It's basically Can You Hear Me from the Chibnall era of Doctor Who, and there's even a similar scene of the monsters from that episode walking down the street. Yeah. And that episode is nighttime, and it's atmospheric, it's on location, it looks great. And this episode, it's broad daylight on the worst studio lot I have ever seen, with houses that are literally just, you can see the facade from the side view. I know the director is talented, he's done good Doctor Who since, but this looks god-awful. There's nothing hiding the cheapness. And then they've sort of got like a background of London sort of superimposed in. And because it's so cheap and so bad, I entirely missed the other wonderful detail about that shot, which is a milk float hovercraft just randomly in the foreground.
I love
and they
that.
Put their money to that for some reason.
Yeah.
The unreality of the shots of London kind of gets at the main thing I have to talk about with the show. It's probably the only thing I really have to talk about is the kind of Australia factor of it all. So it looks nothing like London, like we're saying. It looks like this very cheap facsimile. It's very artificial approximation of London. It looks really bad. It looks embarrassing, I would say. I find that secondhand embarrassing to watch. And it gets to my biggest confusion about the show is, why is this set in London? It was made in Australia. This is chiefly Australians who produced it, who are acting in it. It's an Australian show at the end of the day. Why are we setting this in London? It's not even that connected to Doctor Who. What's the real need to do it? And I think, I don't know how internationally known this concept is, but there's a concept in Australia called the cultural cringe, which is like a big internalized inferiority complex. It's based on this idea that collectively our culture is inferior, especially to the UK and to America, our kind of dominators. And so their culture is superior, and what we should be imitating in place of development or pride or kind of explication of our own culture. Yeah. And watching these young people do these awful attempts at English accents, you know, covering up their own accents, and watching, thinking of them all stuffed into these stuffy studios in Melbourne or wherever it was produced, it just kind of stings watching this. I find it kind of difficult to watch in that sense. But way back when radio was the main way media was disseminated here, our public broadcaster, the ABC, its radio news was read in the exact same accent as the news from BBC London. Why? I think it's a very similar situation to here. There's no real reason for it. It's just Australian accents and culture is seen as less desirable, and UK accents are seen as more desirable. And so I feel like this kind of transference to a different dominant cultural force is what we're playing at here. And I find it kind of ugly to witness.
That makes a lot of sense, because one of our previous, we haven't had an Australian guest on before, so I particularly value your insights in that sense. But one of our previous guests had been talking about sort of various Australian kids shows that they'd seen as a kid.
Yeah, we talked about that, both Hamish and a little bit of Molly, I think.
Yeah. And I think it came up that if you're an Australian actor, one of the first things you have to learn how to do is, you know, successfully or not, you have to learn how to do English and American accents, because there'll be often minimal chances of you being cast in something that's actually set in Australia. So that fits perfectly with what you're saying. And yeah, I can imagine, like, if it was me and, you know, that was where I lived and that was my kind of, you know, culture I'm immersed in, yeah, I would feel pretty kind of, I don't know, stung about that as well. It's kind of, it's sort of weird to me.
I think the successful Australian cultural exports in terms of kids' TV shows tend to be the ones that do embrace Australian culture, things like Bluey or Round the Twist. So it feels just kind of needlessly ironic that we're just imitating the UK for no real merit here.
I mean, also, this is sort of the UK offloading something they couldn't get to work at home onto you guys, because Bob Baker is not Australian, right?
I mean, presumably a bunch of, I don't know much about this, but presumably a bunch of the people who were working on this were, you know, Australian Doctor Who fans, maybe, who grew up watching the show on ABC. I gather it was shown, you know, for many years.
Yeah, absolutely.
On that channel. Certainly Daniel Netheim, I would imagine, is a Doctor Who fan. If he worked on this and then he went on to do Doctor Who, I don't actually know that, but be my guess. But yeah, it's still, I suppose it does feel like a passion project to some extent, in the sense that it is this one guy who co-created a robot dog in the 70s, and, you know, he's obviously always been trying to make him a thing ever since, and finally he's managed it. But simplicity.
That's an interesting note, I think, for this episode, because I feel like we sort of hit the point in the show where it settled away from being a passion project and more into having a groove of its own identity as a show, for better or worse. Like, Tom, you and I both messaged each other to say, oh, well, it's good that this was one of the better ones.
Yes.
I'm so sorry, Neo. That is the level we've been working at.
This is one of the better ones, definitely.
But what it settled into is, I think the money has at this point in the season pretty much run out, because we've watched several episodes now that are very low budget, standard sci-fi concepts that you can do with like minimal costumes, minimal locations. Like this is yet another one pretty much entirely set in the house. And I think that's actually to its benefit because it means they can focus more on the chemistry between the lead actors, which is, I think at this point, kind of growing. They sort of figured out what they want to do with all of them. And so there's just a lot of odd but charming moments. Like Darius has yet another phobia that they've invented for an episode of clowns.
So I don't know if you're aware, Neo, you might have heard this in another episode, because I was just saying Neo's one of our few guests who actually has been listening to, yes. to other episodes. But Darius has claustrophobia, or has yes. been said to have claustrophobia in the past. So now he has, is it coulrophobia, I think, that is the fear of clowns?
Yeah. We're just taking off all the C's.
Just piling them all, yeah. And that feels a little bit clumsy, and, you know, they could have picked somebody else to have that night.
Yes, and this week in K9 is a Dick, he was recording videos of Darius having a phobic reaction.
Just to like play at the Christmas party and yeah, replay it and be like, lol, look at him shitting his pants. That's bizarre.
K9 is actually terrible.
How do you feel, Neo, about this new... he was described by Molly as the F-boy K9. How do you feel about this
Yeah,
version?
He is different. Like, it's quite noticeable that he's more, I don't know if aggressive is the right word, but he's less friendly, I suppose. Mm. I guess it's kind of entertaining. I wish the show focused on him more. I understand why it doesn't. He's a robot dog. It's kind of difficult to foreground him. But I think it's a shame he's off to the side so much, because if we're characterizing him more, like giving him more of a personality, even if it's an unpleasant one, it would be interesting to dive into that more. I think the climax was pretty funny, where he's just flying around and lasering the obelisk, and he's just he's a very aggressive dog.
Yeah, can we talk for a moment about the fact that K9's idea to solve a problem is to try to fly at top speed into an obelisk and then just sort of bounces off?
Yeah, it's this odd mix where they've sort of he's not overpowered, but they have souped up some of his powers in a sense. Obviously, he can fly now, as we've said every week. But
we actually missed it last week. I was heartbroken.
Did we? So he's got all these new things he can do. But also, as we've been saying, they have to kind of take him out of the action quite regularly, I guess, because a lot of the time he might just solve the plot too quickly, or, you know, because he is maybe more overpowered, he has to be kind of taken out of the action and, I don't know... incapacitated in some way, varying sort of things.
I will say, even though the way they took him out of the plot this time for the climax was really dumb, it was like, K9, you brought that on yourself. It did make an emotional sense, because I think the strongest element of this episode, we might as well jump to the twist because it's the only interesting thing, is the monster in a terrible monster costume that's walking around turns out to be June, Georgie's mother, who has been also put to sleep and is sort of sleepwalking as the evil ringleader being possessed, which means we get a nice moment where the mask comes off and it basically replays one of the best classic series twists in, The Rescue.
Yeah, it's a twist so good that I do sometimes think new Doctor Who should do that again. I guess the Slitheen are kind of the inverse of that twist, so you could argue that's playing with it a bit. But that's a lot more familiar, and I'd love to see them do that thing where it's just, oh yeah, the rubber suit is just a rubber suit and there's a person inside.
Yeah, but the advantage taking out K9 for that is you then get to have Georgie resolve the emotional conflict with her mother by herself, which I thought was a genuinely good beat of the kind that this kind of story needs. Was the plot actually built to set that up, where you know that Georgie could put on the helmet and walk into the dreamscape? And the detail of her waking her mother up from a nightmare by showing a heart tattoo with Darius's name on it was actually really funny. Yeah.
That is very funny, yes. I think, I don't know if you, well, this might be different for you, Neo, as kind of not seen the rest, but I think compared to some of the other episodes, this one feels like it, and I suppose this is kind of going against what you were saying about kids versus adults, but this one feels like maybe better than some of the other episodes. It walks a line between doing very silly, goofy stuff that adults might sort of, I guess, wryly smile at, and stuff that kind of, I suppose, could be creepy for young, you know, fairly young children. So I'm thinking particularly of the things like the sleepers who are sort of shambling around like these kind of zombies. yeah, maybe some kids might find that creepy, I don't know. But to adults, it's just kind of, it's patently ridiculous that they've got all these people in sort of these bathrooms.
I mean, that old lady was camp.
The cucumber facial lady, and you know, they're sort of fluffy bathrobes, and there's a guy holding a big teddy, and like, it just, it's obvious that bit feels knowingly ridiculous in a way that I don't think the show has always been. Sometimes it's just been, oh no, I think this is just unintentionally ridiculous. I don't know if that.
I did, well, there was one sort of ridiculous beat I felt was when the like zombie sleeping people are ambling towards the good guys in like the main house, and then they just stop, not because of really the actions of anyone in that room, and then that threat is just kind of gone, and then we move on to the next thing, to the obelisk. That was
that's more of a clunky unintentional thing, I think, probably.
Yeah, there were a few editing holes, I think, in this episode. There's the one part where Darius is suddenly in the car when the scene before he was still in the house. Like, did he give K-9 a ride over to June or something? That was very weird.
Yes, that does feel like there's an odd cut there. Another knowing thing that I would also point to as something that, okay, this is clearly a joke for the adults in the audience, not the children, is... probably one of my favorite jokes in the show, actually, when they're going to a dreamscape at one point. Professor Griffin and K-9 are both in there, and the first thing K-9 sees is a sheep, which is apparently electric. obviously riffing on the idea of, you know, androids dreaming of electric sheep. Philip K. Dick, the book that was adapted as Blade Runner, which, you know, it's not a sophisticated joke particularly, but it's definitely a joke for adults who will know that book's name. It's not a joke for, you know, 8-year-olds. This is one of the few stories where I maybe felt like they were trying to sort of, you know, something that might vaguely keep a parent engaged. I don't know. You could judge how successful or not it was at that, but I think maybe they were going for that in this instance.
It was a cute moment. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Just a few things then that I wanted to bring up. I like that this one draws a little bit on a kind of like mythology and mysticism. Not in any particularly deep way, you know, it doesn't really have anything to say. But I think the show has been doing that slightly more and more as we've been going along, would you say, Kevin? Like, they've had the Sirens, and we've had Ceres, so there was Orthrus, which admittedly is basically just a name, but from episode 8. Then we've got this one. I think later on there's one with Egyptian mythology, and there's one that's called Ouroboros. So there's a few, they're obviously playing around with that sort of stuff, which is, you know...
I think that ties in well to, like we were saying in previous episodes, this feels very classic Doctor Who inspired. And classic Doctor Who is always riffing on mythology when it ran out of plot ideas. I mean, not just stuff like the Time Monster, where it's really obvious, but also stuff like Underworld, where they ran out of ideas and said, let's just adapt mythology as a sci-fi story. That's all over the place, and I think that's an instinct that continues in this show.
Yeah, and I think... it does it more than the Sarah Jane Adventures, which I think only really has the Gorgon. Obviously, that's the big one. And I guess the racist native totem pole, Hetakumtek, or whatever it's called in Curse of Clyde Langer, which this has its own version of, but seems to be less racist to me, anyway. I don't know if you guys felt the same.
It feels like some sort of statement when K-9 just obliterates it towards the end.
Yeah. But
however the obelisk is coded, that's an arresting image.
Yeah, because... We should explain here a little bit that the creature, the enemy here, which is a sort of Celtic trickster demon thing that feeds off nightmares, is called the Bodach, which is a real thing. I looked it up, and my partner's quite into Celtic mythology stuff. So yeah, and so that's part of the backdrop. But then there's a stone obelisk that, to say this, it does not look Celtic to me so much as it may be.
No.
Betrays a certain Australianness. Would that be fair?
Yeah, I felt like it was kind of, as an uninformed perspective, stabbing more towards Maori.
Right, yeah.
Yeah, the main reason I think this isn't as hideously racist as The Curse of Clyde Langer is that, at the end of the day, there is no actual plot details that tie the racist-looking idol to a specific culture to portray that specific culture as a threat to white society. The way the totem pole specifically and wrongly ties it to the plains in the US.
I guess, the vagueness of the imagery. I watched this with someone else and they were thinking Native American. And then I was thinking, it's patterning on some sort of indigenous culture, I guess. But like Kevin said, nothing's really done with it besides it's just the kind of device of the episode. There's no actual narrative we're tying into it. And we're not really clumsily using certain words with it. So I guess that and the amount of people that watch the episode kind of distinguishes it from the Sarah Jane Adventures.
Yes, it's not watched enough for there to be discourse about in the way that the Curse of Clyde Lang has even recently been discoursed about again with Russell T. Davies talking about it in Doctor Magazine. And how
I think if you took to Twitter and said the K-9 TV show is racist, people would just say LOL.
Yes. So building off the mythology dreams stuff, something that I think... This isn't exactly a rejoinder to the point about it looking cheap, because it does definitely look cheap, but I do think the dreamscape sequences look all right. They are obviously very cheap. It's basically just some coloured lights and some, I don't know, what is it, like grass or bushes? Or I don't even know where they are.
They look like the jungles from like Planet of Evil or some other classic serial.
It's very cheap, but I think reasonably atmospheric and effective for this show anyway. And we've not really seen that many sort of explicitly kind of weird dreamscape sequences in the show. So that feels like, oh, okay, yeah, it's doing something a bit different. Other things I particularly wanted to bring up or talk about. The tinfoil hats, I mean, that we mentioned in the intro. Does someone want to explain what the point of that was? Why are we making this joke?
I thought it was great. I mean, I think that was...
Yeah, I like that. It's quite dark. Yeah.
That tinfoil hats. There's not even any effort put in to provide technobabble for why tinfoil hats shield you from the psychic influence of this sleep monster. Because do you need that? Everyone knows the tinfoil hat thing. Even kids get that. And it's just a funny image, especially when you start seeing how every character has their own relationship to them. Mm-hmm. Like, yeah. Most of the characters just put on a standard tinfoil hat. Georgie says, screw this, and like I said, makes really questionable-looking dreads and somehow managed to look worse than everybody else while trying not to. And I like that no character even acknowledges that in the dialogue. It's just a thing she's doing.
Yeah.
And then Darius just can't keep his hat on because he hates it. I'm not sure if he's uncomfortable or thinks it looks stupid. I guess Darius is the anti-masker of the group. And so Darius is possessed because he can't keep his goddamn hat on.
Which nearly spoils everything, right? Because he's the one who then, because he doesn't keep it on, he gets affected. And then he goes and opens the back door that they were supposed to, you know, they should have guarded and lets in the...
Oh my god, this is Glass Onion's character introduction scene years early.
Oh dear. I think there's
with the dreads, she's like the transparent mask Birdie's wearing, you know.
It's true,
watch this. It's all obvious.
Sophisticated character work, yes. So there's the tinfoil hats, which, yes, kind of fairly good gag. And then we've also got a very deserted London. That's another element of it, which in this case is because everyone's asleep, which obviously, yeah, it's quite a budget-saving thing in the sense that, you know, you don't have to film in kind of heavily trafficked areas and you've just got this kind of fairly deserted-looking space. And it echoes things like... Invasion of the Dinosaurs, again, classic series. I guess also the Sarah Jane story, Empty Planet, although I think that might have aired after this. It's a lot of films as well. It's an image people kind of keep returning to because it's fairly striking, isn't it? I think especially if you're a kid, you know, the idea that you wake up and essentially the adult world has been taken out of action, you know, the kind of authority figures or, you know, your kind of your parents or whatever are sort of, yeah, they're kind of again sort of incapacitated or whatever, and they've all just sort of stopped functioning as kind of, you know, reasonable nightmare.
It's also very child logic in how that plays out. Like, you don't see planes falling out of the sky, you don't see car crashes. The milk float, I guess, just stopped and he slumped over while driving it. That's not how any real apocalypse would function, because that's not what this is about. This is very much the fairy tale image of a world at sleep just sort of paused. And I think that is a very childlike anxiety of what if the whole world just stopped? Everything is as it was, just none of it's moving.
I'm curious why the whole show chooses to pitch it so young in that way. Like, going to this level of childlike, is it just the thought that inherently Robot Dog Show is going to be appealing more to 5-year-olds than to 12-year-olds. I wonder why, because the other kids' Doctor Who spin-offs don't really go this young. It'd be interesting to hear the reasoning why they wanted this audience specifically.
Yeah, I don't know a huge amount about this, but I do know that I think there's some... there was some sort of debate or kind of pushing and pulling about what the demographic audience was supposed to be, because in one of the press releases that they gave out in 2009, that it was explicit that the audience was 11 to 15 year olds, which is a fact that
wow.
Yeah, right, exactly, which was a fact that we've brought up a couple of times before. However, in John Bloom's article on K9 for Doctor Who magazine in 2009, which I think might be the only time the magazine has ever talked about it, he says the show is aimed at 8 to 12 year olds, which still maybe slightly older than you might expect.
Yeah.
I might have thought maybe 6 to 10
yeah.
maybe might be more appropriate. But anyway, at least it's a different demographic.
I was seeking out media that, I mean, I liked stories that were big, that had a lot of moving parts and characters, that had, you know, thorny moral questions that made me cry even at times. And this just doesn't do that. This has nothing to actually provoke or challenge a kid. And kids know when they're being talked down to, I think.
This is obviously a separate question from the whole cultural cringe thing. But I mean, do you think, Neo, that there's a lot of... Is that true of a lot of kind of kids' shows over there? That, you know, there's a sense of... you know, it's kind of for children, it's low effort, we kind of can talk down to them.
Well, on Channel 10 specifically, it was airing stuff, you know, most of it was rebroadcasting stuff from overseas. Channel 10 had stuff like Rocco's Modern Life, had The Simpsons. It used to broadcast the Japanese anime in the morning. That's where I used to watch it. So, like, it doesn't have a lot of programming that's specifically this young. So it's not like some cultural Australian thing that we're big into the 5 to 9 year old shows. This show is sort of a odd one out, if anything, I would say, on Channel 10 anyway. So yeah, I'm not sure the thinking there.
One thing, I suppose we haven't really talked that much about the kid characters. What do you make of them?
Georgie felt the most like a character, but her accent also hurt the most. Not that it was the worst, not at all. Just that it was the most clearly trying to be something else. I know you two have compared it to Emma Watson earlier, and I totally agree with that. So that's Stang. The accent of Darius was interesting.
Is he going for Cockney? I think he's going
that
for
Cockney. That was hard to track, yeah.
I don't even really notice Starkey's, actually, particularly.
I thought that hurt as well. It's just... He's clearly trying very hard. And I'm not saying he's doing a bad job of what he's doing. It's very distasteful to me that this is what's being done in the first place. But Georgie feels the most like a character to me. Like you say, the relationship with her mother actually drives parts of the episode. There's stuff going on there. It's not much, but there's stuff. Yeah. I'm kind of talking around the acting here, but something I thought was odd was the editing of some of the dialogue felt like they were leaving in gaps for too long. Like they weren't cutting kind of to where a line ends to a line ends. There was little bits of dead air between lines, and it just made the whole episode feel kind of weird. I think it's one of those things you might not notice consciously, but unconsciously over the course of an episode, it just makes things feel a little wrong or cheap. It just didn't feel very tight how a lot of these dialogues were edited together. That felt odd to me.
It feels like it exists in a sort of landscape that isn't quite professional TV, though, is the...
Yeah.
Fascinating thing about it.
Yes,
this is amateur production territory that managed to get hold of a major IP and get broadcast on some fairly prominent networks. This was on Disney XD in some countries. That's not nothing. It's fascinating to me that this exists, that it got made, that it got aired when all the cards are against it and it doesn't really transcend any of it.
Yeah, it's that element of the sort of BBV kind of mid-90s fan film that, like you say, somehow is also a major network. I mean, Paul Tambs, who's one of the co-creators with Bob Baker, and actually I think plays that is in the clown suit. It's him in one of the clown suits.
That's how you know you're dedicated, because that is
cameo. Yeah, he was like Mr. Floppy Fun Pants or whatever the that was called.
That was bad. That was just bad. I blanked that. That was so
I'm
bad.
I'm sorry. But yeah, no, Paul Tams was involved in, I've said this before in one of the other episodes, but he was involved in making Cushing Doctor fan films in like the 80s and stuff, the 80s, 90s, I think. They tried to make a third Cushing film, obviously without Peter Cushing. But yeah, so, you know, very much fan film background.
I think,
which admittedly Mark Gatiss also has, right?
Yeah. The way this doesn't feel like a fan film to me is that loads of fan films, whether they're well done or extremely poorly done, there's clearly a kind of vision driving them. Someone there really wants to act as the Doctor, or they have some Doctor Who idea they really want to see. Even if that idea is just seeing, hey, it's my backyard, and it's sort of in the Doctor Who episode. There's usually some sort of idea, even if it's just ego, propelling Doctor Who fan films. This canine show, I've only seen two episodes, but I didn't feel any real, like, what's this trying to broadcast to the world? Like, what do the makers want here besides just the canine IP disseminating out to Disney and to Channel 10? Maybe you guys can say, because you're seeing all of it, but I found it hard to tell what's really the point of all this going on. Torchwood and Sarah Jane and even Class, I can see the kind of stuff they want to put out into the world, whether it's done well or not. But here I was just kind of confused. Besides Canine himself, is there, like, it's not engaging with the actual interesting stuff with the setting, which is the weird dystopian stuff with the department and everything going on there. It seems kind of disinterested in it, even in last episode, which is theoretically more directly about it. So I can't really tell what's driving everyone to put this out there.
I mean, the best I can think is I know a lot of people in this world who will do anything to play with the Doctor Who toys, who will chase after the most minor of IPs for years, like,
yeah,
self-published stories, or who will make deals with the devil to work with BBV, all of that, because at the end of the day, we do all love Doctor Who, even the terrible, crappy corners of it like this. And I think that overwhelming fanish impulse meeting capitalism and its demands produces some really weird stuff that has no good reason to exist, but it's the only way people can feel like they're being professional with the toys they actually want to play with. And that, to me, is the energy of this show, really, at the end of the day. I can't judge. I wrote a Faction Paradox short story.
I wasn't going to mention it, but yeah, since you bring it up. I think that's exactly right. And like we were saying with Joy in our discussion of episode 8, as you say, Neo, that one dwelt quite a bit more, I mean, not a lot, but a bit more on sort of some of these dystopian ideas. There is such a weird disjunct between this show having to skew so young, as we've been saying, maybe as young as 5 or 6 or, you know, whatever, up to 10, I don't know, and also being set in, you know, pretty, you know, clearly the kind of grimmest sort of milieu of any of the spin-offs, right? Like, it's a fascist authoritarian dictatorship in 2050. Like, it's a very grim, or, you know, theoretically a very grim view of the future. You know, maybe Britain is actually on that way. I think you could make a fair case. But you know, it plays with these toys like a sort of Guantanamo Bay-type prison, the idea of the microchips implanted into every child and stuff in episode 8. What other things have there been that have kind of toyed with the kind of aesthetics of, I guess the cyber police, the thugs.
The protester being attacked in that one school episode.
Protester and police brutality, that kind of thing. So it's some of the sort of aesthetics of it, but it clashing and rubbing up against the need for it to be extremely sort of, I don't know, juvenile is quite the right... Yeah, juvenile. That's probably the right word, let's be fair. Which is so odd. It creates such a sort of odd atonality, I guess. I don't know.
I don't know. I feel like it's a good note to sign off on this vaguely competent and also baffling episode of K-9.
I guess my only closing thought is that this might be more unique to Australian viewers, but it made me feel bad. Just seeing all these Australian kids do these jobs of imitating English accents and this awful, weird landscape trying to approximate London, and just this whole attempt to pretend it's something it's not for no reason. I really came away with a bad taste in my mouth watching these episodes. And yeah, so that's K-9's what I got out of the show.
Main effect on you, yeah. Do you think, I meant to ask this earlier, do you think this one better, worse, different from episode 8? Because we did, as we mentioned, you have seen both of them.
I preferred episode 8 because I felt like more stuff was going on with the setting, but I also felt it jarred even more with the Australian factor, because that episode ended with the just embrace your own identity and be yourself kind of messaging, which is just...
Like fascism by being yourself, it always works out well, yeah.
Neo, in terms of things that don't make you feel bad, where can we find you?
Who Cares is my channel and podcast. You search that on YouTube or you go to whocares.fun. You'll find that. That's where you'll find me.
Kevin, as usual, gonna plug anything you're doing.
I've been having a rough time of it, and the best way you can make me feel better is by going to, like, go fund someone's transition on a GoFundMe or something. The world is scary right now. Just support people. I don't need the support.
Yeah, amen to that. And as usual, obviously, I run the Canine Bingequake Twitter account. You can tweet us there, give us feedback. We always love to hear from people. By the time this episode is out, my Black Archive book on The Girl Who Died will probably be out in, not in stores really, but available to buy online anyway. So if that sounds like something you're interested in, whether you like the episode, hate the episode, feel like reading a new take on it. Give that a try.
Just for the record, if you don't like the episode, you're wrong.
Yes, that is basically what it takes me 40,000 words to say. Okay, great. Thanks, guys. That was a great discussion.
Great.
And see you around.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
Be safe. Bye.
You have been listening to Canine Bingequake with your hosts, Tom Marshall, Kevin Bernard, and special guest, Neo. This episode, Did Anyone Order a Bunch of Zombies?, was recorded on the 11th of March, 2023, and was edited by Kevin Bernard. Theme music was composed by Jack Geidera. Thank you for listening, and remember to wear your tinfoil hat so you don't crash your milk float hovercraft.